You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 30th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. In the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's another best of 2014. And today on the program, Haley Sweetland Edwards from Time Magazine now, formerly of the Washington Monthly, on her piece about the use of the First Amendment by corporations to roll back worker safety and consumer regulations. What? Sam, really? This is on the best of list? That sounds dry and legalistic. Yeah, it does. Because that's what I like. And you know where else you can get a dry and legalistic, but very, very important topic or hour-long interview on that topic, 40-minute interview on nowhere. So if we don't do it, nobody will. It's a very important development, I should say. It's an assault on our regulatory structure, on the things that keep workers safe, that keep consumers safe. It's a very interesting phenomenon, and you will begin to see, I guarantee you, after we did this interview, over the course of the year, we saw a couple of instances of this. And you'll begin to see more of the she describes in this interview. Again, so yesterday we had David Blacker. We were talking about neoliberalism. We were talking about education. Today, we're talking about how corporations are tearing down our regulatory structure with the aid, of course, of a Supreme Court, which is 5-4 conservative. Also, again, that's why it's relevant in 2015. Everything that happens with the Supreme Court, this stuff is relevant. And you know where else you can get it? Yeah, nowhere. So that's why we're doing it. But Sam, what about that interview with Marin? Well, you'll get probably, I think we may be putting Marin somewhere on Matt is assembled, like I mentioned yesterday, some of the best of the funner half. And, you know, I guess we're going to throw in one or two interviews, too, with, you know, our Friday second guest that we have on Fridays as the style. And so that'll be that. And so I know you'll enjoy it. And, folks, again, I always say this, but if you want to become a member, you know what to do. Go to majority.fm. Click on the Become a Member link. If you don't become a member, who will? And if you don't become a member, who will do interviews like these? NPR? No. MSNBC? Not going to happen. Joe Stevenberg, who is yet to develop his podcast, or Mary Steam Garden? Sharp Shop, who has set up her podcast to go deep into policy? No, they're not doing that. I spoke to both of them the other day. I ran into them. I didn't realize this, but they're dating. And I ran into them on the street, and asked them if either one of them was starting up their podcast, and they said no. We decided not to because we can't do it. So it's just up to you, Sam. And I said, okay. So become a member today if you can. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of 2014. We'll have another best of for you tomorrow. We'll have another best of on Thursday and another one on Friday, and then we're back next week. All right. Enjoy it. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the former editor of the Washington Monthly and now Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, Haley Sweetland Edwards, on her piece that was in the January-February 2014 issue of the Washington Monthly, The Corporate Free Speech Racket. Welcome back to the program, Haley.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really enjoyed this piece. It is a fascinating history into the evolvement, I guess, of the First Amendment. But before we get to that, just tell us about the story involving the National Labor Relations Board that you started your piece off with.
Sure. Yeah. In the summer of 2011, the National Labor Relations Board released a rule requiring all businesses of a certain size to put up a poster in their place of business somewhere where employees would see it, or they could, you know, post it online or email it to employees. If it was physical, it had to be 11 by 17 inches. And, you know, I read this whole poster. It's very bland. It says basically that employees have the right not to join a union, and they also have the right to join a union. And it lays out some of the rules on how employees can be coerced, and basically that they can't be coerced to either join or not join a union. As soon as that rule came out, the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and a whole bunch of sort of corporate entities basically freaked out and called this you know, just this huge intrusion on government rights. They said it would weaken the economy and cause immediate irreparable harm for which no adequate remedy at law exists. And they ended up suing in several courts, and I think it hit two appellate courts finally, and was eventually thrown out. And what makes this interesting is that it was thrown out not on some minutia involving the Administrative Procedures Act, but on the grounds that the government, by forcing companies to post a government poster, the government was actually violating companies' First Amendment rights.
Now, let me just clarify something. By thrown out, the case wasn't thrown out, but the NLRB's rule was thrown out.
Yes, exactly. I should have made that clear. Yes, they could not. Companies are no longer required. There is no rule existing that require companies to post these posters in their places of business anymore.
Now, what's stunning about this, of course, is that the poster is obviously so innocuous. It's simply the act of informing your employees essentially what their rights are. And I mean, give me your sense, because as we delve into the sort of the I would argue, the devolution of the First Amendment in some respects. Is it your sense that this caught the, I mean, when you say they freaked out, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, I mean, it seems to me that there's, based upon your reporting here, that there's also an equal chance that they were waiting for something like this because they are attempting to build essentially a case law.
Of course. Yep. I would say that it's in no way an overstatement to say that we're witnessing a sort of devolution of First Amendment law. And the NLRB rule was in some ways just low hanging fruit for these guys. The reason why I spoke to a lot of people at the NLRB, the reason why they wanted to promulgate this rule now, which they haven't done anything like this in the past, a whole bunch of other agencies have. It's, of course, very common to see government posters on, or government fine print on contracts, on credit card statements, on, you know, those little placards when you walk into a bathroom in every restaurant that says, employees must wash hands. Those are all things that the government is saying, you know, you as a private business have to do this in order to protect customers and in order to inform customers of government protections. So the fact that the NLRB was doing this is not particularly strange, but it does break to some degree with how NLRB has acted in the past. They decided to promulgate this rule now because I think we're down to 7% union membership in this country. I might be wrong on that exact percentage, but it's something around 10%. It's just very, very small. And so NLRB thought that, you know, people should be aware of what it means to be in a union. There's no longer this culture of union membership. And anything involving organized labor these days is, as I said, sort of low-hanging fruit. Business Roundtable and Chamber probably saw this and thought, oh, well, great. We can jump on this, get this thrown out, and add to a whole bunch of other case law that is coming up and we can talk about, that they're beginning to get rules thrown out left and right based on these First Amendment rules.
Yeah,
First Amendment ruling.
So let's go into this. And you wrote this actually prior to the Hobby Lobby decision, which was also sort of based on the notion of a corporation having First Amendment rights. In the case of Hobby Lobby, it was of religious expression. So walk us through this. I mean, where are we now in terms of, and then we'll talk about how we got there, but where are we now in terms of the case law regarding the free speech rights of corporations? I mean, it's obviously, you write about how expansive it's become, and the idea that you could say it infringes upon my free speech as a corporation to have a government poster required to inform workers of their rights, that's pretty expansive.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, so to answer your question as simply as possible, is there, where we are with defining corporate free speech rights is very much under attack. It's very much evolving right now. We have not reached a point in which it's clear where corporate free speech rights begin and where they end. And in this piece, I get into a lot of the history of that. Basically, there's two types of corporate speech. One is economic speech. It's advertising, it's marketing. And that can be, and the Supreme Court has been pretty clear that you can, that the government can regulate that it's subject to a lower standard of scrutiny, to use that, the kind of term that the court uses, that it's okay to regulate commercial speech. And then there's a different kind of speech, which is political speech. And when corporations speak politically, when they're donating to a campaign, when they're, anything that is political, that is not subject to this lower standard of scrutiny. That has to be, that gets the same exact respect in the court of law as you know, you or me going out on the street and standing on our soapbox and talking about our personal convictions and beliefs.
All right. Well, I just want to explicate what we mean when we say a lower standard of scrutiny and a higher standard of scrutiny. So a lower standard of scrutiny means that there's actually more room for the court to intervene they are more hands off in terms of allowing the government to regulate this.
Yes. Yes. So theoretically, if a agency wants to require a company to label or to, you know, false advertising, there's a good example. So a company can't go out and say, you know, my product cures cancer in their advertising. That's clearly commercial speech. And an agency can step in and say, you know, you can't do that. That's a violation of advertising laws. And for us, telling you can't say that is not a violation of your First Amendment rights. And I use that word theoretically before, because that is precisely what's beginning to change.
Right.
Right now, there's.
So let me just, I just want to make this really clear, because this is sort of weedy stuff on some level. It's that, that this is essentially the corporations are using the First Amendment to slowly encroach upon the government's right. I mean, that we all perceive, I think, to regulate corporations and commerce. I mean, this is the game plan, right? I mean, this is what it's attempting to get to, and it's sort of going through this sort of back door almost.
Exactly. Let me give you a really good example. So the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, has promulgated a rule that says that meat packers need to label their meat, telling consumers where the animal in that meat was born and raised. So, you know, was it born and raised in India? Was it born and raised in China? Was it born and raised in the United States? Consumers have, the USDA says that consumers have a right to know that. The American Meat Institute has challenged that rule and brought it all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit, saying the government, by requiring meat companies to label their meat, saying where their animals came from, is a violation of their First Amendment rights.
Because the theory goes, according to them, the government is compelling us to say something.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's funny because somebody in my office just said the cojones involved in there, and I think you use that that expression or something to that effect in your piece as well, because it is sort of stunning that they're but they are, these corporations are beginning to be met with very sympathetic ears from the judiciary.
Exactly. So another example is in the Dodd-Frank law, the SEC was told to create a law that forces extraction companies like, oil and gas companies, mining companies, Chevron and Exxon basically have to tell consumers about where they are getting where the oil is coming from, where their minerals or oil is coming from. That was also challenged by, I can't remember exactly. I think it was the American Petroleum Institute. The DC Circuit Court of Appeals. Saying that the SEC, by forcing those companies to tell consumers where they got their product, that is a violation of their First Amendment rights. They are being compelled against their will to speak, and that's a violation.
And so, what are the state of these cases, and where is it heading? Because, I mean, you speak about a future where there will be no corporate transparency whatsoever. And, you know, it seems to me we're not that far off. I mean, if you can't compel someone to say what the ingredients of your product is, we're not that far off from a company saying, like, well, you can't tell me I can't say it doesn't cure cancer.
Exactly. And we're actually seeing those. We're seeing those cases bubble up, those specific sort of false advertising cases bubble up, which is really interesting. In the pharmaceutical world, for instance, it's long been said that if you're selling a drug, you can't say that it cures something or it treats something that the FDA hasn't sort of determined that it cures or treats. And in a couple cases, we've seen that crack a little bit in interesting ways. But to answer your question about what the state of this is, again, it's very much under attack. That the conflicts mineral case, the extraction case that I just talked about, that was decided, I believe, last week. It was around April 14th or so. It was that it was thrown out on First Amendment grounds. So that's already determined. That is sort of adding to the case law that supports these corporate claims of First Amendment. And the AMI case, the country of origin labeling case, that will be heard by en banc, which is by every single judge on the DC Court of Appeals in May. So we're watching this sort of unfold right now. If the American Meat Institute wins that battle, that will be a huge crack in what most of us sort of think of as First Amendment, as traditional First Amendment rights.
Now, this was, I don't know that I would have thought that I would have ever pined for the days of William Rehnquist. But just to give us a sense of just how radical, and people should remember, I mean, we talk about the lack of nominations that we've seen under the Obama administration, and hopefully that logjam is will break up now following the nuclear option, and in the event that the Democrats hold the Senate. But William Rehnquist gives us a good sort of notion of just how far we've come in terms of what the conservative perspective is on this. And then we'll get into also how unwittingly liberal jurists have also added to this, this devolution of the First Amendment. But talk about when we started to head down this road and what William Rehnquist had to say about it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting politically, and it sort of shows how far right the right has gone in the last 30 years. But to start from the beginning, a lot of this, this whole idea of commercial free speech is, can be traced back to basically this decision in 1975 called Virginia Pharmacy. And that was the Public Citizen, back when it was controlled by Ralph Nader, went after a law in Virginia that restricted pharmacies from posting the price of their drugs. It was actually painted in their windows. They said that the law said that pharmacies can't do that. And Ralph Nader, obviously very liberal consumer rights activist, said, that is actually not good for consumers. We want consumers to be able to compare prices between pharmacies. And in this decision, in the Supreme Court decided in 1976, a year later, and said, you know what? Nader's right. That you shouldn't be able to pass a law that restricts companies' commercial speech unless there's a compelling state interest. And this law at the time was sort of heralded by liberals and consumer rights activists as a victory. And then it quickly from there, I think it was 2 years later in 1978, we see another law, case, which was Bilotti. And this is another, kind of the canon of First Amendment law. This is a huge one. And that was it was using sort of the precedent from this Virginia Pharmacy case. And it said that corporations, political speech, so corporations sort of attempting to manipulate the outcome of a referendum in Massachusetts, which is what that case was about, that can't be restricted either. So suddenly you see, and this is where it all gets very, very messy very quickly, is in the Virginia Pharmacy case, you saw the speech, the commercial speech of corporate entities being protected at a lower standard of scrutiny, again, to use that phrase. And then you have 2 years later, the political speech of corporations being protected at a higher standard of scrutiny. And all of a sudden, this all becomes very, very messy. And over the course of the next, 10, 15, 20 years, you see jurists and lawyers and judges trying to sort it out.
All right, let me just walk people through this just one more time so that they understand. So in the Virginia case here, the consumer advocates were arguing that this farmer, she should be allowed to advertise its prices. Their argument was sort of like the secondary part of their argument was because it helps consumers. But that part of the argument was basically left outside the court. As it were, in terms of how this carried through. So in the lowered standard of scrutiny, the government the government should not interfere and prohibit this speech. In the next case, that sort of principle was taken to political speech, and sort of the government had to back off on the affirmative speech that the company was making. I mean, tell me, just walk me through again the distinction there between the lower and higher scrutiny of the commercial speech in the pharmacy case and the political speech in the Bilotti case.
Sure. So in the Virginia pharmacy case, it was clearly commercial speech. It was advertising and marketing. And the court decided that unless there was a compelling state interest, you can't pass a law that restricts a company's ability to advertise and market itself. And that was, as you said, decided at the time for consumer was brought to the court on the basis of consumers have a right to know that information. But what it had the side effect of doing is basically allowing corporations, businesses, to be considered speakers under the First Amendment.
And so there had to be a really compelling reason why the government would regulate that commercial speech. And that raised the standard, essentially. Is that it?
Yes, yes. And then in 1978, in this Bilotti case, you saw it was not only commercial speech. It was not only advertising and marketing. It was political speech. In this case, it was the First National Bank of Boston saying that we have a right to speak politically, to donate money to this referendum, to attempt to change the outcome of this referendum. And in that case, the court decided if a corporation or if a business is speaking politically, so it's not only speaking commercially through advertising and marketing, but it's speaking politically, then in that case, the government cannot restrict that. It cannot restrict it anyway. They have to treat that sort of speech in the exact same way as it would treat you, Sam, standing out in a park and, pronouncing your views on abortion.
So in other words, it's not just a compelling government reason needed to restrict that speech, but it goes beyond compelling, super compelling, if you will. You can't say fire in a theater.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's really, that's the power of the First Amendment as it's evolved over time, is that it doesn't matter what you're saying or who is saying it. It cannot be restricted by the government.
And this is also this is the big change with corporations too, right? Because we don't, we are suddenly talking about speech as if it is divorced from a human speaking. Okay. Yeah. Just explain that dynamic.
Okay. So in all of these early cases, and Citizens United in 2010, the emphasis is always on the speech. It's always on, it doesn't, they, in almost all of these decisions, they don't even mention the speaker. It's always, is this political speech? And it's interesting because if something is determined speech, then it doesn't matter if it was said by you or me or a Republican or an anarchist. The point is that the speech itself is protected. But as soon as you enter, as soon as the speech that is emanating from corporations is also considered speech, then the you have to call the corporation, the entity that is emitting the speech, a speaker. And that's when you get into this like very fuzzy territory. There's just so many questions that come up there, that basically the court has sidestepped is the whole, you know, the whole thing, are corporations citizens? You know, I mean, it's almost like playing with the language a little bit.
Well,
like,
yes, I mean, because people have to understand here. The question is does the First Amendment provide rights to people, or does it provide a right to a thing that floats in the air called speech? Because right. If it provides it to people, then we can simply say you as a person have the right to speak and say just about anything short of something that would cause a panic in a theater. If yeah. we provide the right to speech to the product of a human being, then all of a sudden it doesn't matter. You just have to prove that it's speech, that it exists. It doesn't matter that there's no one person saying it, that it's a corporation. I mean, that's basically where the subtle shift happens, right?
Exactly. And that goes back to this 1978 Bilotti decision, where it says that bank, the bank's attempt to influence this referendum amounts to speech. And what it didn't say in the decision is it didn't actually go at all into that decision. It didn't attempt to answer any of those questions. If the First Amendment treats corporate political speech the same way it treats political speech, does that make corporations citizens? And Powell, Justice Lewis Powell, just completely avoided answering that question in his in the majority decision. He said that he basically focused on the speech. He said it doesn't matter whether corporations have First Amendment rights. It doesn't matter if they are citizens. The only thing that matters is that that which emanates from them is political speech or not.
Now, here's what's sort of fascinating. People should also note, obviously, Lewis Powell was the author of the Powell memo, which was a memo written, essentially commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce in response to what they perceived as sort of a war that corporations were losing in the country, specifically following, I think it was Earth Day, or in the late 60s, early 70s. And people should also just think, conceptualize this. We in this country, we hear many times that like a foreigner, right? An individual who comes from a different country, comes here, does not have constitutional rights because they're not an American citizen. But this is where you start to see that distinction, right? Because if we were to superimpose this notion of speech is protected, but not the speaker, right? The speaker is irrelevant as long as it suddenly becomes speech. This would implicate all sorts of other issues in terms of what the Constitution, who gets constitutional rights, or not even, or what gets constitutional rights.
Definitely. I mean, the analogy that everyone uses, that all these constitutional scholars use when they start talking about this morphing of First Amendment rights, is they use the word stretch. They say it's just been stretched to the point where it includes everybody, where it has the possibility of including absolutely everybody, therefore excluding nobody, therefore becoming essentially useless in the court of law. And it's a really interesting time. I mean, if you said this before, that if corporations are able to compile enough case law so that their speech, whether or not it's economic or political, is protected at the same standard that your and my free speech rights are, then it will essentially, the government will not be able to regulate them. Any sort of regulation will fall into the category, or could be conceived as speech. Anything a corporation does could theoretically be considered speech. And that includes, in sort of our information economy now, that includes digital exchanges of digital information. And we've already seen a law, IMS Sorrell, I think it was from 2010, saying basically that same thing, that you can't restrict a company from getting digital information that they intend to use in the future, perhaps for advertising and marketing. So it's just this, it's kind of this really interesting, really like fuzzy world right now of what amounts to speech and who can be a speaker under that situation. And if it goes the way the corporations want it to, then there will be no limit. It will be, everything will be speech.
I want to touch on, you make, I think there was 3 points I think you made in terms of why addressing sort of the free speech purists in this arena who would not have a problem, let's say, with like a Citizens United or whatnot. But before we get there, let me just ask you this. In the context of your reporting, I mean, do you have a sense that the agenda behind these cases is about corporate speech and being able to spend money? Or is it your sense that they know where they're going with this in terms of broader regulation?
They know where they're going. I think if you talk to these corporate lawyers, I think they drank the Kool-Aid. I think they believe what they're saying. And it's interesting because you have these archetypal liberals, like Lawrence Tribe and Dellinger, and you have these guys who sort of made their name, and Floyd Abrams made their name defending the First Amendment back in the 60s and 70s when it was used to protect anarchists and dissidents and the New York Times and the Pentagon paper case. And you have them also defending corporations now, because they say their point is basically what we've been saying. It doesn't matter who's doing the speaking. It only matters what the speech is. And they've drank the Kool-Aid too. they honestly believe, and I respect the hell out of these guys, and they honestly believe that this is correct. On the part of the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and things like that, I don't think that you could plausibly say that they don't know exactly where this is going.
Right.
Challenging the country of origin labeling rule based on First Amendment grounds, they know exactly where that's going to go.
All right. So let's take these arguments. I mean, you write that the First Amendment purists, I mean, you're talking about those guys like a guy like Tribe. They argue if we limit the definition of speech or wade into the muck deciding who gets to be a speaker under the law and who does not, then we position ourselves on a slippery slope. In other words, if you start to say that corporations can't have free speech, then it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to saying, you know, vegans can't have free speech.
Right, exactly. And that's really the specter, the sort of terrifying idea that they hold up. They say, you know, as soon as you start limiting speech, then you can say, anarchists can't speak or Muslims can't speak or vegans or whoever you want to say, you know, they don't get the same rights as speaker. And as I say in the piece, I think that's just, it sort of seems to me like just sort of blatant fear mongering. You can draw the line and you can say, any single human being in America has total free speech rights, absolutely no holds barred. And then, but you draw the line at human beings. It just doesn't apply to corporate entities.
And you know, I mean, this is the other thing that I'm raising before we get to your second point about what a purist would say as well, is that has there ever been an attempt to simply say, look, they are not capable of political speech because they are commercial entities? Like they can never, because they are licensed as a commercial entity to do commerce, that everything they do is commerce in the context of a corporation. Like they're, even when they engage in politics, it is commerce. It is from money that was derived from their status as a commercial, exclusively a commercial being. Has that principle been argued at any given point?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course it's been argued. And interestingly, it's been argued sort of originally by Rehnquist and Bork and these sort of traditional conservative justices. They're the ones that when these decisions on commercial speech first started coming down in 1975 and 76 and 78, saying they're the ones who raised the red flag and said, oh no, this is not going in the right direction. That Bork said that the protection of the First Amendment must be cut off when it reaches the outer limits of political speech. And that's a direct quote. He was not into this idea of commercial speech at all. And then Rehnquist says the same thing. He says the logical consequences of the court's decision in this case, referring to Virginia Pharmacy, a decision which elevates commercial intercourse to the same place as had been previously reserved for the free marketplace of ideas, are far-reaching indeed. Oh. Bork and Rehnquist, these guys were saying exactly what you're saying. They're saying a commercial entity exists because our laws allow it to exist in order to perform a commercial function. That is completely different than you and me who exist despite the fact, we don't exist because our laws allow us to exist. And this gets to the second point that we were talking about before, that it's that the First Amendment purists will say you can't restrict speech to any speaker because, you know, that creates this slippery slope. And then if you give the argument that I just gave, which is, okay, fine, cut it off at human beings and non-human beings, they'll say, well, what about when human beings get together into a group? And again, they make that seem like it's this very scary thing, but it's not. Each human being inside that group still retains all of his or her rights. You know, you can be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and you can still go out into the park and scream and yell about whatever political idea you want. You don't give up your rights by being a part of a corporation. And the corporate entity itself is already treated differently under our laws. They're taxed differently. They have different privileges. They have different, they can't plead the fifth. A corporate entity can't plead the fifth. A human can. And they have limited liability.
There's a whole set of, well, once you incorporate, you're a different being, essentially.
Exactly. And you're treated differently legally. I mean, limited liability is a great example. It's if you mess up, you know, your books as a corporation, you are treated differently legally than if you mess up your books as a human being. It's just the idea that you can't treat that, you know, human beings differently than you treat corporations is just a completely silly notion.
And so under your what you're proposing there, what happens to something, let's say, like a union, or what happens to, let's say, an advocacy group?
Well, what do you mean, what happens to them?
In terms of their speech. I mean, is their speech then limited as well?
Well, they need to, each individual advocate is not limited in any way. You know, if you join Planned Parenthood and the mere fact that you are a human being who stands under this umbrella of Planned Parenthood doesn't mean that your rights are in any way abridged. Your free speech rights are totally unabridgeable. They're absolute. But the free speech rights of the advocacy group, of the organization, of the union, of the corporation, all those things are the same. All those things are artificial organizations of human beings. They can be, though, that speech can be treated differently.
Right. And so that speech as well, like a corporation, would be subject to a government interest.
Exactly. Yeah. And they can fight for those interests in the same way, you know, on the ground, in state houses and local court, elections. They can fight for those rights in the same way that any other entity does. They just can't use this constitutional right intended for humans.
And of course, I mean, well, let's go to just the third point here, and that's that which is I've heard raised on several occasions. What do you do about MSNBC? Because they're owned by GE and Comcast, and you know, at one point they were owned totally, or at least the majority, by GE. This is a big arms manufacturer. I mean, what do you do in that instance? Do you say that the you know, Chris Hayes can't go out and advocate for, you know, he doesn't have the same right to go out and advocate for liberal policies?
Well, so that's a, this is also one of these First Amendment purist scare tactics, is they say, well, as soon as you limit the speech of corporations, then you're destroying freedom of press in this country. But that just doesn't make sense, because in the First Amendment, press is specifically listed as worthy of the First Amendment's protection. It actually, the founding fathers actually called out press and said, you know, this law applies to all humans and press. So they say, you know, the idea of limiting this law in order to carefully define and afford protections to editorial activities to Chris Hayes, then that it's written into the law itself. That doesn't mean that you have to afford the rights and privileges of GE's speech. That's not an editorial activity. And that, you know, it does get interesting. I mean, these are not black and white issues. These do require debate. And I don't mean to be oversimplifying it here. You do have to say, I mean, there's a really interesting case involving Standard & Poor's that's been going on for more than a decade. They say that their ratings are speech. They call themselves that's an editorial activity. They say, you know, each of those ratings is the world's smallest editorial or whatever the phrase is. And the courts have bought that. They've said that Standard & Poor's ratings fall under the category of editorial activity. So of course there's gray areas there. Of course, right, that needs to be litigated. But the idea that you can't restrict corporations' free speech without killing freedom of press, it's just, you know, I mean, it's just sort of fear mongering and using one of these slippery slope theories. Just, it's insane.
Well, there you go. You don't, my credit score also, just a little tiny editorial that, all right. Well, Haley Sweetland Edwards, the piece is The Corporate Free Speech Racket. We've got a link to it. Really appreciate your pointing this out. I mean, it's a fascinating story of the evolution of the First Amendment, and it also makes, I think, it brings a broader understanding when we start to see why all these corporations sort of line up to fund something like Hobby Lobby. It's not just because they know there may be some electoral advantage to having this narrative of religious oppression. It's because there's a larger agenda at work here. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
Folks, yesterday in California, yesterday, blocked three busloads of immigrant families that were being transferred to a federal facility in Riverside, California. More than 100 people waving American flags and holding signs that opposed new illegals waited in the hot sun. Oh, they really showed a tremendous amount of effort in their bigotry for the three charter buses to arrive at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Station in Marita, California. Federal agents tried to avoid a conflict by taking a route that steered clear of the front entrance, but instead the crowd blocked the street and forced the buses to make an unplanned detour. "We can't start taking care of others if we can't take care of our own," said protester Nancy Grayson, 60, of Marita. Just contemplate this for a moment, folks. You know, I was talking to Goldie Taylor on the Ring of Fire yesterday, and nobody in Washington is listening to us, the protesters say. This is just out-and-out bigotry. You've got thousands of children warehoused, literally warehoused, on our border now. And ask yourself a question. What would happen if instead of tens of thousands of children, brown children, were warehoused on the border of this country? What if they were Irish? What if they were Australian or Canadian? How many senators do you think would be out there saying this is an outrage? These are children. I mean, this is just out and out bigotry. And the idea that some of these yahoos are in Marita, California. Marita, California, founded in the 1800s by Ezequiel Marita. Now, granted, he was Basque. So you've got these protesters out there going, we will not stand for our Basque heritage to in any way be diluted by these Central Americans coming up here. It will make Ezequiel Marita spin in his grave. And after he gave property rights to his brother Juan Marita, we cannot have the nature of this country from El Centro to Temecula to Los Angeles to Las Vegas. We cannot have the nature of this country changed in such a way. It will be practically unidentifiable. I mean, imagine going to El Centro and not being able to understand anything because it's all in Spanish.
The Basque cultural identity is already deeply under threat in the Spanish homeland. They have been fighting nobly to try to preserve their unique way of life, and I will be damned if we cannot preserve that way of life right here in Marita.
Marita in El Centro. And Temecula and Los Angeles is for Americans. Our American heritage is steep and runs deep in Marita. And in fact, it's true of all San Diego County. Unbelievable. These bigoted morons.
Want another drop of the Spanish language here in Marita?
I draw the line at El Centro.
Oh my God.
I mean, look.
Oh my God.
There really is no legitimate complaint about immigration that is not a function of bigots like this making it impossible to have any type of cohesive immigration policy. I mean, if you have one, call me. Tell me what it is. I'm curious.
Well, I'll tell you what it is, Sam. It's about preserving the Basque way of life and the historical dignity of the Basque people in California. You ain't never heard of Basque separatism? What kind of liberal are you?
We must maintain our traditional Basque culture in Marita, California. Not in any way to be confused by those partial Spanish and indigenous people from Central America. The Basque way of life, it's going to mean an entirely different tradition in our weaving of baskets and in the cuisine that we eat. We're going to change the nature of our olive oils and our...
Like some traditional lemon chicken stew, Sam.
It was bad enough when they opened a tapas bar here. Serving traditional Spanish cuisine as opposed to a more Basque-influenced cuisine.
Oh, my God.
These racist
It's just, that's, I mean,
morons.
Let's be
honest. That's
it. That's it. That's
it. Can you imagine you're on your deathbed and you're like, hey, what did you do with your life? Well, I mean, it was this great time where I harassed these migrant children on a bus.
Oh, we showed them migrant children. You think you can be 8 years old, cross the border, deal with killers and murderers who would kill you and then come here and get past me? No, sir. That is not the American way.
What kind of sociopaths are slow? An 8-year old child just got here alone.
I made one cry! Did you see me? I made one cry! Chalk one up for me!
I bet he didn't cry the whole time. He was hitchhiking from Guatemala, and look, I got through to him.
Boo hoo! What are you going to do? Cry like an 8-year old?
Well, I guess literally he would cry
right,
like an 8-year
cry
old.
Like an 8-year old.
Because he is.
Oh, look at you. Oh, what's the matter? Can't find your papa? Your papacito! Unbelievable. Just the sheer sociopath of these people.
Disgusting human beings.
Here's Louis Gohmert as an in-studio guest on Point of View. I'm not sure
Just a radio show.
Radio program.
It's identified everywhere. It just says Point of View Radio.
There you go. And he was talking about the notion of the Obama administration sending several thousand members of the U.S. military to West Africa, or Western Africa, I should say, to assist in the effort to control Ebola. Said it was, of course, the latest example of the administration demonstrating its fundamental disdain for the military. Then he got on the subject of don't ask, don't tell. And this is what Representative Louis Gohmert had to say about gays in the military.
I've had people say, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with, gays in the military. Look at the Greeks. Well, you know, they did have people come along who they loved, it was the same sex, and would give them massages before they went into the battle. But you know what? It's a different kind of fighting. It's a different kind of war. And if you're sitting around getting massages all day, ready to go in the big planned battle, then you're not going to last very long. It's guerrilla fighting. You are going to be ultimately vulnerable to terrorism, and if that's what you start to do in the military, like the Greeks did, as people have said, Louis, you got to understand, you don't even know your history. Oh, yes, I do. I know exactly.
Yeah. You studied military.
Not a good
history.
Idea.
Yeah, I studied history, and I know that you can't have our military personnel getting massaged on the battlefield. You can't.
Now, in ancient Greek conventional warfare, that's entirely one thing. A massage may be beneficial, but in a guerrilla operation, a massage is liable to get you killed.
The Greek pre-battle massage methodology is just not called for in modern times. Now, I have you know, I know my history. I have studied the massage pre-battle methodology. I use it in my daily life if I'm going to lunch that I think in any way could be a involving conflict. I will get my pre-Greek massage. I will do it sometimes post-lunch to get my pre-Greek.
Post-lunch pre-Greek massage.
A Greek pre-battle massage. I will get that. I've watched the videos. Over and over again, I watch all the Greek videos.
There's a lot of those videos floating around on the internet and elsewhere and even on VHS. But that does not mean in a modern battlefield environment that the massage is going to benefit.
This whole program where the Obama administration allows gay Greek masseuses to travel with the military to give them the traditional pre-battle Greek massage that is just going too far. It costs too much money.
And they say that, you know, they want to defeat ISIS with it, and I'm the one who's uneducated and crazy. I mean, that's how the elite mind works.
I'm not one of those people who's going to say, I don't wear togas, or when I spend my downtime in my congressional office, I'm not wearing a toga, getting a Greek massage.
I'm not one of those fellows who's going to tell you that.
But I'm not in battle.
Like a small, nice, young Filipina gentleman rubbing hot massage oil over my vulnerable body. But that does not mean that I support it in a battlefield context.
Now, the Romans, they were much, they would actually receive their massages in the course of battle. Which would also be, now that would be probably a little bit more in tune with our current military practices. So in other words, if you have a drone operator who could actually be receiving a Roman-style massage.
A back rub from one of his heterosexual friends,
right,
in a heterosexual unit. For a heterosexual relaxation.
Does Louis Gohmert have any idea of what he's talking about? This is the amazing thing. Is he's sitting there going, I know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, here is something that is completely fantastical. And don't tell me I don't know about my fantastical knowledge. So he thinks that having gay people in the military means having gay people's lovers or partners travel with them to the field of battle, and before they go out to battle, they get a massage from them?
Hey, Bob, I'm going to need you to shut down the shop for a couple of weeks and come to Kandahar. I'm going to need it's a counterinsurgency. But it's going to be a pretty intense operation, so I'm going to need the full body treatment for a couple of weeks. We block aside some shower time, but just get somebody to watch.
Now, are the straight guys in the military, are straights getting the pre-battle massage as well? They're just not.
Well, that is perfectly, that is okay. A female brought along.
Now
he's
going to try to tell me that not all the Greeks were homosexual. Okay, sure.
Let's go to the phones.
My history, Sam.
You're calling on.
Gay Greek bastards.
I've watched all the videos on the Greeks. I saw the one with the parody account of Zach Galifianakis.
There's a History Channel.
Very
there's a
hairy
Spice Channel. There's
all right.
Sorts
let's
of
go
channels.
To the
300 was pretty good.
It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
You're calling from a 917 area code. Who's this? Calling from a 917.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your name?
Daniel.
Daniel, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I'm a libertarian, and I'm calling, I guess, to discuss with you, because I know that you like having libertarians on, I guess, to debate.
Sure. What would you like to discuss?
Pretty much anything, I guess. I guess my first question is, how would you define a libertarian, and why, and what do you disagree with?
Well, let me ask you. You're the libertarian. How do you define libertarian?
I define a libertarian as someone who believes in the non-aggression principle, who says you own your body, you own what you produce, and you have a right to own the fruits of your labor. You have a right to freedom of association. And that no one should violate your person or property without your consent.
Okay, and so, and how do you establish personal property? I mean, do you think the government has a role in establishing personal property?
I think you establish personal property either through homesteading, which is mixing your labor with your land through inheritance, through gifting, through a trade.
Not through currency?
Through currency? I'm fiat currency, you mean? I mean, or through...
Yeah, fiat currency. Do you recognize if
I buy...
Of
money...
Hold on, let me ask you. If I buy a piece of land with fiat currency, do you consider that I own that that property?
I mean, you currently are forced to use fiat currency because we have legal tender laws.
Right.
So since you're forced to use it, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing so. But the whole reason money exists is to solve the double coincidence of wants problem in barter. Because if we're trading in barter, which is just inefficient, I have to have what we both have to want what the other guy has. So money exists as a universal medium of exchange, which everyone wants, so we don't have to go through 50 guys to trade something. And
right.
Certain things aren't divisible. He gives someone half a car.
Right.
But you don't need government to have money.
You don't need government to have money.
Right.
How do you, under what mechanism would you have this currency, how would it function?
How would what function?
Well, this currency. I mean,
currency emerges... currency emerges naturally. Have you ever gone to prison? They use cigarettes in prison as currency. People used to use corn and salt. I mean, it emerges naturally. Right now, in prison, they use cigarettes as a form of trade and currency.
Yeah, okay. So in prisons where they don't have access to money, but they also don't have access to a lot of different things to buy and sell. I mean, so...
Right.
Are you suggesting that we don't need, I mean, that in the context of society, when we're not caged as animals, that this would emerge naturally? So what currencies have emerged naturally without being issued by some type of authority that have functioned well in society?
Well, all currencies originally came from things that originated as barter goods, right? Someone didn't just say, okay, I'm printing a piece of paper and now it's worth something.
No.
Even fiat currency emerged started with being backed by gold, right?
No. I mean, these currencies basically started by, were issued by the king. They were issued by the king, and they gained value because they could actually pay the taxes that the king levied.
Well, yes, that's why fiat currency exists, to force people to accept it because it was only redeemable in taxes. I don't disagree with that, but that doesn't explain why government needs to run the currency.
Well, they
right?
need to have the authority to compel people paying taxes. So that the currency has some value to everyone in that society.
But you haven't really explained why you need government for that. You sort of just said that...
You need some authority. I mean, you can call it whatever you want. You want to call it a king? Call it a king. You need some authority to say, here, we're issuing currency. This you can pay off the debt that you owe to society. We're going to force you to pay this debt to society. I know... that you probably perceive taxes as some type of theft, right?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, taxes are you don't voluntarily pay taxes, right?
Well, actually, you do. You'd have to go to prison if you didn't. But yes, you are compelled.
Well, that doesn't make it voluntary then.
Yeah,
if you go to prison if you don't
compelled.
Do something, how's that voluntary?
All right, fair enough. You're compelled to pay taxes. Exactly. That's what gives money
right,
its value.
Right. But why should you be forced to pay for something that, let's say, you find morally reprehensible, right? So you're against, I would imagine, at least certain things the government does. Let's say a war
right.
that you're against.
Right.
You think it's right to be forced
yes.
to fund a war killing people, innocent people, against your will? You
think
it's justifiable to someone to take your hard-earned
yes.
money and use that to as
yeah.
an aggressive
yes.
aggressive against others?
Yes. I disagree with that with the war, but yes, I am obligated to pay taxes, and I think that is appropriate because I don't think society can function otherwise.
Well, but I'm not really sure why you say that because I think you've mentioned
you just asked me the question,
in certain videos that.
You asked me the question, and so I don't believe that society can function without taxes, at the very least, because that's what gives our currency value.
Or with people picking and choosing what they could.
What do you mean? If things have value because people value it.
No, our currency has value because you can pay your taxes with it.
Right, but I mean that's why people are forced to accept it. But the value that it has is still dependent on market forces, right? Why is Zimbabwe's currency not worth near as much as the American currency? So just because you're forced to pay taxes on something doesn't make the currency worth a certain amount.
Well, to the extent that the Zimbabwe currency has any value, it is because I suppose you could pay Zimbabwe taxes. But the point is that. The American dollar, if you did not have any taxes, then the value of printing that dollar is based on nothing. I mean, it's just an agreement, and it would just sort of wither away at one point.
What do you mean? It has the value that it has is to reduce transaction costs and to remove the double coincidence of want, problem, and barter. That's the function of money.
That's
it
the function
value
of
because
money,
I can buy goods and services with
but
it.
But the way that we agree,
I pay taxes,
the way that we agree that
because
it has
I can
value
go to a
in this
store
country.
And buy stuff.
All right. The way that we agree it has value in our society is because we can both pay our taxes with it.
Well, it has value because we can buy goods and services with it. It has value
that's
because...
Right. That's right.
Right.
But the reason why we can buy goods and services with it is because everyone in our society has got to use it to pay taxes. It's the only thing they can use to pay taxes.
Okay, but if they didn't pay taxes or they and government didn't create this thing, that doesn't mean... Government can't create a need. The need exists. You can argue that maybe government can fulfill the need, but
yeah.
Government can't create a need. Government can't say, you enjoy bananas. You either enjoy bananas or don't. It's possible for government to supply the bananas, but they can't supply the desire to value that those bananas have. You either
that's
value
it.
Them or you don't.
Right. All right. Well, let's move on to something else that's a little bit less ethereal.
Sure.
Now, do you have a problem with the existence of taxes?
Do I have a problem with the existence of taxes? Yes, because they are coercive. They imply that the government owns a percentage of your income and they can take what they want and give you the rest and leave you with the rest.
Right.
And they're all, and also not only, but the main problem that I have with paying taxes is twofold. One, it's a violation of your property rights, and two, the things that are going to pay taxes, many of which are used.
All right. Yeah. So
in a manner
I get
which
you. Don't like,
would,
you don't
I
like how your tax
are
dollars
aggressive.
Are spent. We all share that frustration at one time or another, I imagine. But let's talk about this. I mean, so why are your property rights? It's a violation of your property rights. Who set up your property rights?
Who sets your property rights?
Yeah.
You're saying government determines what rights you have and don't, and without government, no one has any rights?
Well, I'm not saying that without government, nobody has any rights, but certainly it's government who enforces those rights and who helps structure society in such a way for those rights.
Right, but I mean, it is true that government currently may, in certain instances, defend property, although it also violates it as well.
Right.
But the fact that government supply, I'm not denying that the government does many things which are useful. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a fallacy to say because government does X, only government can do X.
Well, we don't need to say right? X. So who is going to, who is it that is without coercion going to defend your property rights?
I hire someone and I say, if you defend me, I will pay you. People have security guards. People have, there are mall cops.
Okay, so,
I mean, you know.
So only wealthy people who can afford paramilitary groups get their property rights defended. Is that what you're saying?
Now you're turning it into an emotional argument. Only
no,
people,
I'm just
I don't
saying
know why
what you
it
said.
Would necessarily be so.
Well, how am I going to pay for this paramilitary group to protect my property rights unless I have money? I mean, I want to protect my my iPhone, but I don't have money to hire a security guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, so should government provide everything? So should only rich people be able to afford paper? Should only rich people be able to afford a phone? Unless you're going to take that argument to its logical conclusion that the government can provide everything, if there's one thing you don't want the government to provide, I can use that same argument to you and say, oh, so only rich people should be able to afford whatever it is, that one service that should be left to the market?
I'm not following what you're saying. You said to me, I said, who's going to protect your property rights? And you said, I can go out and hire somebody to protect my property rights. And I'm saying, well, what if I don't have the means in which to hire somebody to protect my property rights? How is that fair?
Should we have a
market
in food production, or should
answer my question?
I'm answering it. I am. Should government control the market? You go to a supermarket and they sell food. Should government say we are going to control the food supply? We're not going to let the market.
No.
Make food, we're going to monopolize the
but
food.
But I think
industry.
The government should regulate certain things about it. You see, you have to understand something,
right?
Okay? I am not stuck in a rigid dogma. I actually look at the world and I respond to problems based upon some very broad notions of what I think will benefit the most amount of people in society. You are the one who has a rigid philosophy that says there can be no coercion whatsoever. And that's why you run into problems. That's why you can't answer my question. If property rights are so sacrosanct and you don't want government, you don't think government needs to be the only vehicle in which to protect those property rights, and you tell me that you can hire somebody to protect your property rights, I say to you, well, what about the person who can't afford to hire somebody, their own private police force, for property to protect their property rights? And your answer is what?
Well, you have lawyers who work pro bono. You have charitable organizations. Look, it's not.
So wait a second. Somebody comes to take my iPhone, and I say, "Hey, you can run away, but I'm going to sue you with a pro bono lawyer."
Pro bono Blackwater.
Well, first of all, I think if I commit an aggression against you, let's say I steal your phone, right?
Yes.
Well, someone would you would be taken to court, and
But wait a second. Who's taking you to court? What coercive power is going to make me go to court?
If I steal your phone, you would take.
I'm not going to go to court.
Huh?
I took your phone. You want me to go to court? No. Make me.
Okay, I'll make you.
How are you going to do that?
Huh?
How are you going to do that?
How am I going to do that? Well, obviously, against your will, if you don't agree to it.
How?
Well, through the use of force.
Okay. How? Well, I mean, because I got news for you. Guess who I got here?
What?
I've got my own little private Blackwater. Screw you, buddy.
You got your what?
Tell it to my paramilitary.
You got your what?
Tell it to my paramilitary.
Sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you repeat it again?
Yes, tell it to my paramilitary. The point is this. What you're talking about is feudalism. And I don't think it would be very fun for you to live in a feudal world. That's that. What you're promoting is feudalism. I get that you have some belief that we can live in a society where there would be no coercive power. But the reality is that you can't. I mean, the reality is that you can't.
Why do you think the government is going to give you justice? I mean, look at the recent Ethan Couch
case. I think that the government
sometimes
gives you justice. And that's why a lot of times I argue for more justice. But guess what? There is no world where you're going to go and there's just going to be justice. That only exists. I don't even know if they do TV shows like that because it would be pretty boring. But the reality is that's a fantasy land. You're in La La Land.
I think you have to live life based on principles. So I think, is the initiation of the use of force justified or is it not?
You know who also says that? Fundamentalists.
Huh?
Fundamentalist religious people.
What?
Who live on such rigid systems of principles. I mean, yes, I think there's some very broad principles you can live on.
Wait a minute, you don't have principles you follow?
No, I do.
Okay, fine. So why would that? So you have principles you follow. I don't know if that makes you rigid. I would say that makes you principled.
Do you pay your taxes?
Right. You have certain.
Do you pay your taxes?
Well, yes.
Okay. Well, why are you not living according to your principles?
Because morality ends where a gun begins. I'm not advocating that people martyr themselves and that people get thrown in jail.
Oh, so you do compromise on your principles. You do compromise on your principles. You do compromise
look,
on your principles.
Hold on a second.
You just decide I'm going to compromise on my principles when I'm faced with the idea of jail time. But I'm telling you that I have broad principles.
So let me ask you this.
That I live on until I find out they're not effective in the real world. You just arbitrarily choose.
If I'm against bullying and I'm in high school and a bully says to me, give me your lunch money or I'll beat the crap out of you, and I don't want to get hurt, so I give it to him. Mm-hmm. Am I compromising my principles? Am I being a hypocrite? No, I want to get beat up.
Do you think the government should be involved in the federal government should be involved in collecting taxes and building highways?
I think you know the answer to that question.
No, just answer it. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, the answer is no.
Okay. Do you drive on highways?
Yes.
All right. Now, is anybody forcing you to drive on that highway? Is anybody going to take you to jail or beat you up if you don't drive on that highway?
No.
So you compromise your principles because you find the world as it is, and you drive on the highways because it makes your life easier and because you like it.
I'm not against highways. When did I say there should be no highways?
You just said the federal government.
I never said we should.
You're compromising your principles every time you get on the highway, buddy. Guess what? You're also compromising your principles when you don't have your own water supply.
How am I compromising my principles?
Why don't you go drive on a highway? Well,
huh?
But you don't think they should be financed by federal government that's collecting taxes, yet you drive on those highways.
Okay. Right.
You've compromised your principles.
How am I compromising my principles?
Jump to the Civil Rights Act? You think if a state makes it legal to own slaves, it would be okay?
If the state makes it legal to own slaves, would it be okay?
If a state. Do you think the Civil Rights Act is wrong?
I don't think it's okay to own slaves. Why would I think it's okay to own slaves?
Do you think the Civil Rights Act, do you have a problem with the Civil Rights Act? The one that says that you have to serve people at your private establishment, regardless of race?
A private business, you mean?
Yeah, a private business, like a restaurant.
Yes, I disagree with that part of it.
Of course. Of course you do.
Look, you think it's funny. Let me ask you this. If you have a sign outside of the front lawn of your house that says no black people allowed, should the government says, sorry, if a black person knocks on your door, you have to let him in?
No, I don't think that's right. Because it's not a place of business where people are engaged in society's economy.
A business is still private. A person can say, I don't want to sell to you.
The business is still private.
It's my property, and I should get to determine
who
sells for me or not.
There's the Commerce Clause, buddy. The business is not private. It's doing business with the public. Business is a public enterprise. It is a public enterprise.
If someone walks into your studio and you don't like him, or you think he's a shit, or for some reason, you shouldn't have the freedom to say, sorry, I don't want you in my studio, please get out?
If I do business in my studio where I serve people, I should have no right based upon his color or his creed or his gender, or her gender, I guess, their gender.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, their sexual orientation to kick him out. That's what I agree. Yes, that's what I believe.
Look, I think that, you know, being a bigot,
it's bad for business. But, buddy, that's not what we're talking about.
What's not what we're talking about?
Whether it's bad for business or you disagree with bigots, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking
right,
about whether or not every individual, regardless of race, of color, of sexual orientation, should have the same right to engage in our economy, in public businesses, as, let's say, a white guy might.
Have you ever heard of Smith College? That's an all-girls school.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they have denied men from attending that school because they have discriminated based on gender. If you're a man, this is a girls-only college. There are also boys-only colleges. You're saying that's immoral? They shouldn't be allowed to do that? How can Smith discriminate based on gender?
You know, I mean, I actually think that there's a decent argument there. I think there's actually sort of a decent argument about that.
You're saying there should be all schools should be co-ed. No school should be allowed to be same sex.
I mean, I think that there's a decent argument that, yeah, that all schools should be co-ed. I mean, I suppose one could argue that there is enough opportunities, but I tend to think that you may have a good point.
All right. Okay, good. At least you're consistent. But look, I mean, also from a practical perspective, if you're forced to associate with people you don't like,
you're not forced to associate with people you don't like.
You're probably going to hate them more.
No, when you open a business, when the government gives you a license to open your business and do business with the public, then you must be subjected to certain rules. When you get a license to drive, you're forced to wear a seatbelt. You're forced to go within the speed limit.
Okay.
All right. Listen, call back because it was an enjoyable conversation, but I got to move on.
All right. Sure.
All right.
Nice
appreciate the phone call.
All right. Take it.
Bye. All right. Now we're way backed up. Let me get to this story about Jenny Martin, because we had talked, I guess, a couple of months ago. There was a story out about how little the Tea Party groups have actually given to candidates. And this is when I say the difference between the Tea Party and the Republican establishment is not about ideology. It is simply about money flows. It is two companies within the same industry, Coke and Pepsi. And I have been saying for years now that the reason why this virulent strain, this unmedia-trained, semi, I guess, populist in the worst sense of the word movement on the right, the rise of the Republican base has been happening is simply because there has been new sources of money that have flowed into them. The Koch brothers, over the past 15 years, have gone from being worth several $100 million to literally hundreds of billions of dollars. And they have just funded this base because they basically just wanted to go in and they wanted a power structure. And so now there's money just sloshing around in just an enormous amount. So you have this story of Jenny Beth Martin. In Mississippi, Jenny Beth Martin and the Tea Party Patriots try to prove their worth. I don't know why I'm using that accent.
What other accent are you going to use?
Exactly.
I mean, let's be real here.
The head of the National Tea Party, she is on track to make $450,000 as head of the Tea Party Patriots. It's written into her contract that she can ride first class anywhere in the country, but according to her lawyer, she doesn't use that perk.
It's more of an option thing. It's just a respect. It's a sign.
Yes. We all recall how much the Tea Party hates the idea of anyone riding first class, like, for say, Nancy Pelosi. But let's put that aside for a moment. The interesting part about this story is not just that they have now put in $800,000 supposedly into a McDaniels raise. The interesting thing is not just that these groups are raking in money and giving very little out to candidates. The interesting thing about Jenny Martin's story is that before she was head of the Tea Party Patriots, she was a software manager who quit her job to get fertility treatments and give birth to twins. The temp agency of her husband, Lee Martin, which I guess he ran, went belly up. They had a debt of more than $500,000, so they filed bankruptcy. They allowed for government intervention to stand in the way of them and their creditors. Now, of course, I'm sure when they don't like all these rules and regulations that are hurting our economy and keeping us from living in a true free market, they don't mean bankruptcy, corporate bankruptcy. A corporation, an entity that is licensed and chartered by the government that allows them arm's length distance from liability, not the least of which protection from their own personal assets from the creditors who are owed money by his company. She is, according to this piece, has had to publicly contend the fact that she and her husband filed for bankruptcy. But less well known is the fact that her husband accepted unemployment for a time. I never said there should be no safety net. She says that decision was more difficult for him than the decision not to stay in our house. We were scraping by. In other words, you see, he is different.
It should be a safety net, not a hammock, unless it's funding the hammock that my husband's laying in while he's not working.
You understand that unemployment benefits are for the regulars, not the irregularities who voted in this Mississippi race. Mm-hmm. It is for me, but not for thee, as it were. We were scraping by, not like those other irregular types. And you've all read the stories. You know we have problems who have been collecting unemployment insurance. That's different because it's us. And now, of course, I'm making $450,000 a year fueling an organization that would do away with unemployment insurance for the irregulars. I mean, this is the perfect example, right? I mean, honestly, these people are a joke. The joke may be on us because they still continue to dominate, at the very least, congressional elections in enough parts of the country so that they can do things like make it impossible for things like long-term unemployment insurance to be extended. But this is the reality of the Tea Party and Chris McDaniel.
Sam, you are quite right to note the fraud that is rampant across the Tea Party movement, which is why today I am launching, along with several other leading conservatives, Tea Party Patriots, USA Patriots, Together Act Now to Save America. And the family. Thank you for that addition. That's very important, Matt.
What is the acronym for that?
I don't think you remember.
FAMSA. We'll just call it that. Anyways, in a time of rampant communism, threats to the fundamental American way of life, irregular voting patterns, mass migration, and the undoing of the American currency as we sink further and further into debt into the Chinese and terrorists move across the Middle East, we must have true, authentic American patriots acting to save America together today. Stand now, we stand together for America. Honestly, Sam, I get a headache, actually, trying to keep up with all of the notes that we must hit. But the point is I was never on unemployment insurance. I never complained about my job in a rock quarry in Robben Island like that communist socialist you had on yesterday.
To be fair, who was paying for your room and board at that time?
The reason that I was struggling against the apartheid regime is so they would be so liberal as to pay for room and board of our prisoners. Okay. My initial objection to the regime was, as I told you, the small allocation of health care in the Bantustans. This is why we created the African National Congress. And this is why we struggle today against Obamacare and the ravages of Kenyan socialism that he is laying on the country. Believe me, I have seen Kenyan socialism firsthand, Sam.
I don't doubt
that
it.
Place is a hellhole.
All right. Well,
so go to Tea Party Patriot USA for families today. Sign up for our newsletter. Also, if you sign up today, there is a special offer for investments on a gold band powder that will give you life extension, insure your IRA account, and protect your family in the face of inevitable social collapse. Also, Alex Jones secretly works for the communist cabal. I'm very sorry to hear this. And I guess my point is we were going to have a joint venture before, but all he right. screwed me over by working with Dr. Group. And we have our own iodine powder. We have our own Tea Party group. No unemployment benefits. We will save America together. And we do not have to slide into the recessive theta male Social Security-fueled debt collapse that Sam Cedar and others of his ilk advocate for. Thank you very much.
Say it and I will pay.